Thanks for listening to Latino USA. I want to tell you about a new way to get the news each morning. Up First is the morning news podcast from NPR. In 10 minutes or so, you get a sense of the stories and big ideas of the day, the stuff you really need to know and why it matters. Start your day with Up First, weekday mornings by 6 a.m. Eastern Time on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Latino USA. I'm María Hinojosa.
Que usamos en las dos noches pascuales, el que la gada. ¿De dónde viene?
This is Rabbi Mario Roisman of the Beth Torah Benirach Synagogue in North Miami Beach. Today he's leading a monthly study hour called Café con Torah, or Coffee and Jewish Law. Today, the session is all about the Exodus, the biblical story of Moses leading the Israelites out of Egypt. Rabbi Roisman is originally from Argentina. The crowd joined here is from all over, Venezuela, Bolivia, Cuba, and Argentina. Now, while Miami is known for having a lot of different Latino communities, and perhaps equally for having a very large Jewish community, what you might not know is that these two groups frequently overlap. That is to say, there are a lot of Spanish-speaking Jews in South Florida. But Rabbi Roisman says it wasn't always like that.
The last 13 years, the demographic of the synagogue changed dramatically. What I mean dramatically is that we can speak that one-third of the congregation is from a Latin background, or put it in a better way, Judíos Latinos.
That's because many Jewish families from across Latin America, in particular, South America, have been migrating to the United States since the 1980s. They've been driven by political upheaval or a lack of safety in their home countries, the same reasons why anyone leaves anywhere. Now, this migration has changed South Florida's demographics, but it's also changed the demographics of the Beth Torah Synagogue.
But it also impregnates the flavor of how to be an American Jew. I am, you know?
How to be an American Jew when you're Latino, and how to be Latino when you're Jewish. During the holiday of Passover, we're rebroadcasting an episode from 2015 that looks exactly at this specific question. One of the attendees at Rabbi Roisman's Café con Torah session was reporter Veronica Saragovia. She was born in Colombia, but listen to her life story now. It's a fascinating tale about how Jewish and Latino came to be for one family.
That flavor of being an American Jew that Rabbi Roisman mentioned, in my family, it means speaking Spanish and Hebrew and English at any family gathering, like a Passover Seder. That's my Aunt Martha. She's leading us in the bracha, or blessing, for the Sabbath candles. Everybody at the table who's under 30 was born in the U.S. Everyone 30 or older was born in South America. But my ancestors are originally from Eastern Europe. Their journey from what was Greater Russia to Miami spans the better part of a century and was shaped by major events in history. We almost did make it directly to the U.S. I had a great-grandfather who left Ukraine by boat in the early 1900s, thinking he was sailing here.
But shortly he would find out that instead of the States, his ship was going to Brazil.
That's my mom, Estela.
So he ended up in Brazil. He had no one in Brazil. So he said, what do I do? And he had no money left. So he sold his boots that were no longer useful in Brazil or anywhere that was warmer. And with that money, he bought a ticket for Argentina, where he had a cousin. And that's how he ended up in Argentina.
On my father's side, the story's a bit more complicated. That side of my family is originally from Lithuania. Here's my uncle Efrain talking about his father, who grew up with eight brothers and sisters.
They were born in a little village called Shvincian, and they were born there, yes. My father's family, they were a very large and poor family.
They lived in a shtetl, a humble town made up of mostly Jewish families, like the kind in Fiddler on the Roof. They raised livestock to sell in the market, but one day their father was shot and killed by a thief.
There were nine kids in a house without a father. They had no future there.
10 years later, my dad's father, then just 22 years old, left for Colombia without any money or any Spanish. 3 years later, in Poland, my dad's mother, who had known my grandfather before he left, decided to follow him to Colombia. She left shortly before the Nazis invaded the country and killed most of her family. Here's my uncle Efrain again.
She would never stop crying. As a child, I remember her crying almost on a daily basis. So it was a tough life for her.
The only member of my grandmother's family to survive the Holocaust in Poland was her sister. She joined the resistance fighters against the Nazis. After the war, she left Trieste in Italy and joined my grandparents in Colombia, where my family had started a leather tannery and remained in that business for almost 50 years. Generally, our lives in Cali were happy. My family was part of a tight-knit Jewish community made up of other recent European immigrants. They felt welcomed by the Colombians. That was important to my grandfather, so much so that he changed our last name from Sragovic to Saragovia.
He thought that it was much easier for the Colombians to say Saragovia than to spell Sragovic.
But in the late 1970s and early 80s, militant insurgent groups in Colombia threatened the safety of many families, Jewish or otherwise, including mine. My dad, Angelo, says soon after I was born in 1982, the only choice was to leave. Who was targeting us?
It was the M19 guerrilla group that was kidnapping, at the moment, people in Colombia.
This insurgent group, M19, was even kidnapping members of our family.
Well, there was a confrontation at the time between the Colombian army and the M19 guerrilla. And one of their members got killed, and in his pocket he had a list with our last name written in it.
That list that the M19 member had was of kidnapping targets. M19 was targeting wealthier families that could afford to pay ransoms. And now my family knew that this included them. In 1984, the insurgents kidnapped my father's uncle, Bernardo. For 4 months, they chained him to a tree and barely fed him. My family was forced to pay the ransom, and Bernardo was released. He joined the rest of our family in Miami, where we had moved a year earlier. From Eastern Europe to South America to the U.S., my family survived. Even though they've been through a lot of suffering, they found a way to carry on. At the Friday night Sabbath, all of our traditions blend together.
We had brisket, rice and beans, Colombian empanadas, as well as the Jewish challah bread. I feel equally comfortable with the three identities, being an American, a Latino, and a Jew.
So, Veronica, thank you so much for all of that reporting there. But what about you and your identity right now in Miami?
Maria, for me, I don't know exactly where I fit in. And I say that because if you put me in a room with Latinos and American Jews, I'm more likely to run to the Latinos. I just feel very comfortable among Latinos. And I found that people have a hard time putting together that I am Latina and I am Jewish. But in Miami, there are so many people like me who don't fully fit in one or the other. We're a blend. And I'm very grateful that I have a city that I can call home.
Veronica, thanks so much for telling us your story. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Maria.
So, how many Jewish Latinos are there? Well, it's hard to say. But if you look at statistics on Jews of color from groups like Bichol Lashon, it's likely that there are over 100,000 Latino Jews in the United States alone. And according to the American Jewish Yearbook, there are about 500,000 Jews in Latin America, with large populations in Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, Mexico, and Panama. So, Veronica's story and her family history, it's not exactly so unique.
Really, there was very, very, very little Jewish life in Latin America until the 19th century.
That's Jeffrey Lesser, a professor of Latin American history at the University of Sao Paulo in Brazil. He's written a number of books about different Brazilian minority groups, including Japanese Brazilians and Jewish Brazilians.
Today, when we talk about Jewish Latin Americans, we are talking in huge, huge part of Jews who came to Latin America in the 19th and 20th centuries from Europe or the Middle East.
Lesser says Jews were leaving their homes for Latin America for the same reasons they were leaving for the United States.
You have political movements and cultural movements that are anti-Semitic, that are violent, and Jews are fleeing from those areas. You have people who are in somewhat better circumstances, but see the Americas broadly as a place of opportunity.
Now, Jews arriving in Latin America in the 19th and 20th century faced anti-Semitism in much the same way that they did here in the United States. Despite that, Lesser says, in Latin America, the Jews were able to attain a higher social status much faster than they were here in the United States. There, they quickly became business owners, politicians, doctors.
Because of the very unfortunate distribution of wealth, that particular immigrant groups come and immediately, because they're either not indigenous or not of African descent, are immediately in an incredibly privileged position in a way that took longer to construct, for example, in North America.
So Jews were allowed to become whiter faster.
Or I would even say Jews got off the boat whiter. A second part of it is here in Brazil, many Portuguese, many Spanish, many Italians worked on plantations as replacements for slaves. Whereas Jews, Arabs, Japanese never had that. They didn't work on other people's plantations. They either lived in urban areas or became landowners themselves and things like that.
At this point, we also have another dynamic, which is Latino American Jews. So where is the public conversation now about the state of Jewish Latino, Jewish Latin America?
I certainly understand it because I have a pair of 22-year-old twin sons who are Jewish Latinos, who hold citizenship in multiple countries or brought up in multiple countries and think of their identities in this complex kind of way. In the United States, there is very, very little discussion of Jewish Latinos. Obviously, there are some exceptions. Hopefully, a conversation like the one we're having today begins to move that forward a little bit.
Coming up on Latino USA...
Yesterday, I said hi to a Jewish guy. I just said, like wave my hand.
And why did you say hi to him?
Because I want to be friends with Jewish people.
But first, young Jewish Venezuelans find a religious home in New York City. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Latino USA are committed to bringing you honest, ethical, and critical journalism from diverse perspectives. Did you know that our newsroom is 78% women of color? If you support diversity in journalism, please donate today. Go to latinousa.org and click on the donate button. And please consider supporting us with a monthly gift. We are part of an independent nonprofit media organization dedicated to bringing our listeners real stories from the new American mainstream. Support diversity in journalism, and please, donate today at latinousa.org. Every penny goes towards our work and our mission.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, whose National Hispanic Advisory Council is devoted to educating the Hispanic community about the causes, treatment, and prevention of cancer. Learn more at cancercenter.com. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing justice and opportunity for people in need. More information at publicwelfare.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. So when I was growing up as a kid in Chicago, I actually used to hang out at the local Jewish community center, the JCC. I wasn't Jewish, but I used to light the menorahs and I used to play with dreidels. And the thing is, I didn't even know back then that JCC stood for Jewish Community Center. Anyway, today on our show, we're talking about being Jewish and Latino. So, imagine you're a young Jewish Latin American arriving to New York City for the first time. You see synagogues everywhere, but they're American synagogues where everybody speaks English, each with their own style of practice. These new Latin American arrivals to New York simply aren't going to synagogue at all. Or at least, that's what was happening 6 years ago. Then, Rabbi Mendel Whiteman, himself a transplant from Brazil, set out to change that. He started an organization specifically for Latin American Jews. It's called the Jewish Latin Center, or the JLC. Ailish O'Neill visited the JLC to find out how this rabbi's plan is working.
27-year-old Ariel Fleischer has been coming to the JLC ever since he moved to New York from Buenos Aires 4 years ago. He came here because he landed a job at J.P. Morgan's corporate headquarters. When Ariel first arrived, it was Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the most important Jewish holiday. His older brother, who used to live in New York, suggested he go to the JLC for services. From that first day, Ariel says, he knew this would be his synagogue because of the community he found there and because Rabbi Mendy was so welcoming.
Por la impresión que me dejó el rabino Mendy Whiteman, ¿no?
This community for Latin American Jews living in New York didn't always exist. The Jews did, but the community didn't. In fact, when Rabbi Mendy first arrived a decade ago, he kept encountering lonely Jewish Latinos in the city.
This is the people that have all doors open for them. They are successful. The families are successful. They're important in the community, in the society, developers, lawyers. And they come to New York and nobody knows you, nobody cares about you. You're just another person. And for them, this is very difficult.
This is an enviable problem. These are people who have high-paying jobs at J.P. Morgan and hedge funds and law firms. They aren't worried about how they're going to pay the rent. Most of them speak English. You know, when I talked to, had visa problems. But urban isolation is a real problem nonetheless. So 6 years ago, Rabbi Mendy and his wife Frumi founded the JLC. It wasn't easy.
I remember, you know, my first high holidays, we had 9 people. We couldn't even get a minyan, which is 10 Jews to pray together.
According to the Torah, 10 Jews, usually all men, is the minimum number necessary to be considered a real congregation.
Until, you know, slowly people start getting to know about the idea.
Today, Rabbi Mendy has hundreds of people on the JLC's email list. Plenty of minyans. The community is constantly changing as people move in and out of New York. You have to understand, this isn't a bunch of families with kids. It's a kind of adult youth group, mostly young professionals in their 20s and early 30s.
We see every day people that tell us that they have been living here for 8-10 years and never celebrated Passover, was never invited. They were never able to get into a temple. And our mission, first of all, is to bring them together.
Time and time again, I heard from members of the JLC that they visited other synagogues, but they didn't feel welcome there. When Moises Eskenazi first arrived in New York, he tried out a Mizrahi synagogue, attended by Syrian Jews.
But it didn't feel like my home. I think the main thing is, in Latin American synagogues, we feel like we're all friends, even though we just met. And at the synagogue, I was the new person who didn't know anyone.
Moises grew up in Caracas, Venezuela, and he moved to New York 5 years ago. He works as a software engineer in the Empire State Building.
Not having a place like the JLC is like not having a home. It's like being alone in this big city that has so many people, and at the same time, you need to know someone in order to live.
The sense of home is that the sounds are kind of the same in a way. The praying in Hebrew, but with a Spanish accent, is pretty unique.
Leon Skorniki went to elementary and high school with Moises. Being lonely Venezuelan Jews in New York brought them closer together, and now they're best friends.
I think Hebrew spoken with American accent is horrendous. And I'm sorry.
Shema Israel, Adonai Eloheinu.
The service is in Hebrew, but he, when he gives that little lecture...
That is, when Rabbi Mendy gives a shiur, which is a short sermon.
90% of each lecture is in English. And then every now and then he'll sprinkle words in Spanish or Portuguese. And oftentimes he asks, sometimes he doesn't know every single word in Spanish, so he'll say it in Portuguese and people will tell him, oh, it's, you know, this word in Spanish.
Growing up in Venezuela, León and Moisés went to different synagogues because León's family is Ashkenazi, which means they follow traditions from Eastern Europe, and Moisés' family is Sephardic. They follow Spanish and Mediterranean traditions. These are the two main groups of Jews. They have very different traditions and, as a result, often develop separate communities. But here in New York, both León and Moisés go to the GLC, which follows the Eastern European Ashkenazi traditions. At first, that was jarring for Moisés.
The services at the synagogues I had been in Venezuela were a lot more intense in the amount of praying and the joy of singing. And the Ashkenazi melodies are more mellow. And I feel that they're a bit sad. Reminds me of like... Yom HaShoah Remembrance Day.
That's the day that commemorates the Holocaust. And the JLC doesn't just bring Ashkenazi and Sephardic Jews together, it brings together Jews in another way as well. Almost all of New York's other synagogues are splintered according to the specific beliefs and practices of their members. They're Orthodox, Conservative, Reconstructionist, or Reform, essentially a sliding scale from the right to the left of the Jewish spectrum. But at the JLC, everyone worships together under one roof. Even many Jews who are not Latino come for services, saying they're drawn by how welcoming the community is.
You know, if they feel they don't want to come for service, they want to come after service or the food, it's fine. You know, they're celebrating Shabbat in their way.
The JLC still doesn't have its own temple, so Mendy's a kind of itinerant rabbi. On this morning, he's praying at the Fifth Avenue Synagogue in Midtown. On Fridays, he leads services for the JLC in a rented space. And throughout the week, he gives short Torah classes in office buildings.
People work so many hours in the city, and they're so consumed by work and stress. People are looking for meaning, for something more true.
Rabbi Mendy guesstimates that there are tens of thousands of Latino Jews living in Greater New York, and he's only reached a small percentage of them. As he keeps growing this home away from home for the Latin American Jews culturally stranded in the city, he hopes to raise enough money so the JLC can buy or build its own building, so the Jewish Latino community can have a home of its own. Here's León Skorniki again.
If our communities back home, we didn't have that teaming up and everyone sort of pooling resources to build these institutions in the countries where we grew up, if we don't replicate that here, this may not exist in a few years.
And León's friend, Moisés Ashkenazi, agrees. They need the JLC.
If we identified only as Jews and not so much as Latin Americans, we would not have a Jewish Latin center. We would just go to any synagogue. It's New York City. We can choose where to go. And we don't feel at home at any of these synagogues, so we created our own.
Eilish O'Neill reported that piece from New York City. And New York is, of course, known for being a very Jewish city. And in the Brooklyn neighborhood of Borough Park, there's a different kind of Jewish-Latino mixture going on. In this case, it's a Mexican church that is an offshoot of the Church of God Seventh Day. Seventh-day Christians, you might not know, are otherwise traditional Christians who draw much of their doctrine and symbolism from the Old Testament, just like the Jews. But this church, of mostly Mexican families from Puebla, is located right in the middle of one of Brooklyn's largest Orthodox Jewish communities. And for the kids growing up in this church, that leads to some very interesting questions. Debbie Nathan has our story.
It's a Sunday in September in the Brooklyn neighborhood of Borough Park. Thousands of Hasidic Jews live here, the strictest of all Jews. They're getting ready for a holiday called Sukkot. Sukkot is a harvest-themed festival, and families buy ritual plants to celebrate. In this community, people speak Yiddish. The women wear long skirts and wigs. The men have curling locks of hair near their ears, and some wear enormous furry hats that look totally out of time. It's like stepping into an old-world shtetl with cars. A few Latino immigrants are here, staring quietly. They live in the neighborhood, too. I'm off to visit some of them at the Iglesia de Dios Israelita nearby. Translated, that means the Israelite Church of God. On the way, I pass makeshift huts called sukkahs in Hebrew. Jews put these sukkahs outside and eat meals in them during the holiday. Some decorate them by hanging up a few apples and pears. Jewish sukkahs are modest little things. But then I get to the iglesia. Inside the sanctuary is a humongous produce palace. Hundreds of pounds of fresh, fragrant fruit hang on strings, 600 pounds to be exact. An 8-year-old named Tiffany Galicia helped put all of it up this morning.
We got a lot of fruits. We got bananas, and we got pears, and we got watermelons. We have it because God sent to celebrate this festival, Cabañas.
Cabañas is the Iglesia's Spanish word for what Jews call Sukkot. Both words mean huts. And besides a cabaña, the Iglesia has other Jewish features. The congregation celebrates their day of rest on Saturday, not Sunday. On the podium is a six-pointed Star of David. Some church members can sing the Israeli national anthem in Spanish. They even refer to themselves as Israelitas, Israelites.
Mientras en lo profundo del corazón palpita un alma judía.
The immigrant adults of the Iglesia know they're Christians. Jesus is their Messiah. But their U.S.-born kids are growing up in a neighborhood of people who are dramatically and visibly Jewish. They're kind of confused and very interested in their neighbors. Here's Tiffany.
Yesterday I said hi to a Jewish guy. I just said, like wave my hand.
And why did you say hi?
Because I want to be friends with Jewish people.
But the Jewish neighbors rarely return the children's greetings. Their silence makes the children sad and obsessively curious.
I have a question, and my question is, how does it look inside in the Jewish synagogue?
Why the men of Jewish people wear hats?
Do mostly Jewish have pets, like dogs or cats? Because mostly my dad told me that they don't, but I'm not sure about that.
Most Hasids won't even talk to secular Jews, Jews like me. So I'm almost as confused as the church kids. And then 9-year-old Noeli Ramos talks about this amazing, mysterious thing that always happens this time of year, right in front of the church.
Like last year when our cabañas finished and we're going to go home, I saw like a big group, like a big march of Jewish people, of Israelites clapping and singing, I think for joy or something.
I learned that in the fall every year, observant Jews celebrate the holiday Simchat Torah. That's when they finish the annual cycle of reading their holy book, the Torah. Some Hasidic men stage a big, noisy parade. Now a bunch of kids and I are on pins and needles waiting for it.
All the Jewish to come. Oh, yeah, get in. They're coming. Why does only men do that?
The questions never stop. I prevail upon a lone post-parade man in one of those fur hats.
Okay, excuse me. Do you have a minute?
I'm actually starting to pray right now.
Oh, because these children wanted to ask a Jewish person about what a synagogue looks like inside. They're so curious. Do you have a minute just to tell them very quickly?
It looks exactly like a church.
It looks like a church.
We pray.
I feel bad. So do the kids. But there's one chassid who will help. Through a friend, I get in touch with a young rabbi, Joel Laban. He's the real deal. He lives in Borough Park, and he assures me that he has a huge fur hat at home.
My grandparents are all from Europe, and they were all Hasidic rabbis. My grandfather was a survivor. He had 8 children before the Holocaust. They all perished.
The murders of Rabbi Laban's family and countless other Jewish families reverberate today, all the way to Brooklyn.
It's still in the psychic of survivors to not trust too much and love too much the non-Jewish neighbors.
But Rabbi Laban wants some trust and love.
We're a closed community, but we live in New York. We need to have contact with neighbors.
You guys can come in.
And that's how the children of the Iglesia de Dios Israelita finally end up talking with a neighborhood Jew.
Shalom, hermanos.
Shalom. He tells them to call him Rabbi Joel.
Kids, let me ask you before. Who is smarter, the one who's asking a lot of questions or the one who has a lot of answers? Who is smarter?
At first, the kids look mind-boggled, but they warm up to Rabbi Joel after the question of whether Jews can have pets.
Yeah, it's okay to have pets, but you know what? Jewish people have big families. When you have 7 children, you don't need cats and dogs. Your house is already full, right? So I have 6 children.
What?
Yeah.
What? Oh, my God.
Still, there's that burning issue. Why the Hasids won't talk to the kids.
You know about the Holocaust?
He explains how the Holocaust has made Jews afraid. But he says that's no excuse for not talking to the children.
So a Jewish person who's not nice is doing a mistake. In our scriptures it says, you should be the first to say hi, to greet your neighbors. And not only your Jewish neighbors, not only members from your community. You have to be nice to all mankind, to all people.
The best thing about the visit is the rabbi just being there in a cozy room with his neighbors, especially when he takes off that amazing thing he's wearing, his furry, otherworldly, and very Jewish hat.
Who wants to try Okay, I will give it to one of your teachers, and everyone should have a chance.
It feels hard. It's heavy, though.
Tiffany tries it on last.
I'm soft.
Oh, you look good. You can take also this and walk into Borough Park.
That was Debbie Nathan reporting that piece. And wow, those little kids. I hope they make lots and lots of friends in Borough Park. And coming up on Latino USA...
He spoke basically 15th century Spanish that he wrote in Hebrew letters.
A centuries-old Jewish Spanish language. Mm-hmm. Stay with us. No te vayas.
NPR is working with the Knight Foundation to better understand how listeners like you spend time with Latino USA and other podcasts. Please help us out by completing a short anonymous survey at npr.podcastingsurvey, all one word, .com. It takes less than 10 minutes, and you'll do all of us at Latino USA a huge favor by filling it out. That's npr.podcastingsurvey.com. Thanks.
Du bist das will ich euch, du bist mein Herz, mein Moch, du bist das Wesel von dem euch bei mir. Ich hab nur ständig ein Gedanke, ich hab nur ein Verlangen.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Embry Family Foundation, working to expand awareness, explore possibilities, and elevate consciousness through philanthropy and community building, and Americans for the Arts. For more than half a century, committed to transforming America's communities through the arts and arts education, in partnership with local, state, and national leaders. Learn more at AmericansForTheArts.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today we're talking about the intersection of the Jewish and the Latino. And here's a test now for all of you Spanish-speaking listeners. Listen closely and see if you can translate this.
En boca cerrada non entra la mosca.
Want to hear it again? Okay, here it goes.
En boca cerrada non entra la mosca.
In a closed mouth, flies don't enter, which is a proverb saying that if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. So even if you don't speak Spanish, it probably sounded like Spanish. It sounded familiar. Producer Julia Alsop joins me in the studio now to tell me what it is that we're listening to.
So that clip is actually spoken in Ladino, which is the language of Sephardic Jews.
Sephardic Jews, so those are the Jews that were cast out of Spain in the 15th century.
Exactly. That's why Ladino sounds so similar to Spanish. It's made up of 15th and 16th century Spanish words.
So it's kind of like a Spanish version of speaking traditional Old English, right?
Exactly. And that's why it should be pretty intelligible to most Spanish speakers. Professor Devin Narr, who studies Ladino at the University of Seattle, has another example of how Ladino and Spanish are similar, but not quite the same.
Good afternoon is buenos tardes, which is very similar to Spanish, you'd say buenos tardes.
But Ladino borrows elements from lots of languages, like Turkish.
Instead of saying ¿qué tal? For example, in Spanish, you'd say, like, what's up? In Ladino, you'd say ¿qué haber? And haber comes from the Turkish word for news. So ¿qué haber? Means what's new, what's going on.
There's also Arabic, Hebrew, Greek, Bulgarian, French, and Italian.
You have the entire Mediterranean and Middle Eastern universe encapsulated in this language.
That's because Sephardic Jews mostly settled in the Ottoman Empire, today's Greece, Turkey, Bulgaria, etc., after they were expelled from Spain in 1492. Until the 20th century, Sephardic Jews continued to speak Ladino. In fact, in the Ottoman Empire, Sephardic Jews were the only ones speaking a Spanish dialect, which led to some difficulties when they migrated to places like New York in the 1920s and 30s.
And one of the most distinctive sets of populations that Sephardic Jews would encounter in Harlem were other Spanish speakers, and in particular, Puerto Ricans.
And Sephardic Jews shared more than just language with their new neighbors. Dating between the two groups was apparently common.
Some people think that this is a very nice idea, that this will, you know, bring together a kind of community, but others are very concerned about the mixing that will take place. And this is the language of the time. Concern about the possibility of intermarriage, the concern about the dissolution of Jewish identity, the concern about assimilation.
Devin's own grandpa settled in Harlem from Salonika, a city in northern Greece. And while Devin didn't grow up speaking Ladino, he did grow up hearing his grandpa speak it in the home.
He spoke basically 15th century Spanish that he wrote in Hebrew letters. And at a certain point, I decided to take greater interest in the language and the culture and asked him to speak to me in that language.
Today, he's functionally fluent, though opportunities to speak it are kind of rare. There are a few native speakers left. Globally, there are about 14 million Jews, and while that might seem like a lot, only a small percent of those are Sephardic. And of that group, it's impossible to say how many of those Sephardic Jews actually speak even a little bit of Ladino.
People still know some greetings. People still know some prayers. People still know names of foods and the specific kinds of cuisines.
Devin is doing his best to stave off total extinction for the language. His university houses the world's largest digital archive of Ladino source materials. There's also a Ladino concert series and conversational group on campus. And he's not alone.
When you lose a language, do you lose a life, a history of these people, a culture? In a way, yes.
That's Brian Krishan, who started UC Ladino, a Ladino culture and conversation group at UCLA.
No invisí a mis criaturas de hablar Ladino.
PhD student and UC Ladino co-director Peyton Phillips Quintanilla brought a cake to today's Ladino class. She tries to bring Ladino into her everyday world, but incorporating a 15th century Spanish into 21st century Los Angeles can get a little confusing.
Things I always have to keep my eye on is the spelling, because we don't use the spelling that we do in modern Spanish. For instance, I ordered a cake for today, and one of the words on it is felicitaciones, which everybody uses in Spanish nowadays. But at the bakery, everyone spoke Spanish and they wanted to correct the spelling. So I had to write everything out and ask them to please not correct the spelling. And it gave me an opportunity to tell all of them about Ladino and Judeo-Spanish.
These connections between Spanish and Ladino are what drew in Jennifer Gutierrez, a UC Ladino member who's also a native Spanish speaker.
There's actually a lot of dichas y proverbos that Ladino people say that I can be like, whoa, that, we say that in my house, or that's very similar to something my mom says. And the words are similar, but yet they're so different, and I think that's what interests me the most, to see how something...
Jennifer is Mexican-American. Like most of the club's six members, she found Ladino through academia, not ancestry. There are around 6,000 languages spoken in the world today. About half of them will become extinct within the next century. And it's not like those languages are being replaced with other, newer languages. They're mostly being replaced by more dominant languages, like English.
Every language encapsulates an entire world, an entire universe, an entire posture toward humanity and toward the physical world, everything. And so to fight for Latino or to fight for any other endangered language, I think, is to take a small stand against the homogenization of the world's cultures.
That was producer Julia Alsop. So, we've discussed some of the complexities around identity when it comes to being Jewish and Latino. But there's a side of this we haven't talked about yet. In Berkeley, California, reporter Maya Cueva experiences her identity of being Jewish and Latina in a different kind of way. Here's Maya Cueva.
This is what I wake up to in the morning at my parents' small house in Berkeley.
Have you eaten, Maya?
My cousin Rosa is here with her baby. In the living room, the mantles are covered with dusty menorahs on top of colorful Guatemalan molas. In our glass cabinets, Russian porcelain dolls lean against artifacts from Peru. My parents go for anything that blends my mom's Jewish and dad's Peruvian sides.
One day I was just getting ready to go out. I don't remember what I had on, but Feli comes up to me and he says,
"Are you going to go out in the shmata?"
Feli is my dad, and shmata is a Yiddish word for a rag.
I was just sort of shocked to hear him use the Yiddish word. And all of a sudden, I just thought to myself, this is meshuganismo.
Meshuganismo. The word just came to her like that. Meshuga means crazy in Yiddish, and the ismo makes it like craziness. But our particular craziness. It's where oy 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 meets ay ay ay. It turns out, once they had me and my sister, she needed that word a lot. My mom comes from a very lefty, secular Jewish family in Chicago. My dad immigrated there from Peru when he was 18. They met in 1970 through a mutual friend. My dad asked her if she wanted a ride on his motorcycle.
When I met him, I thought he was cute.
Oh, my God.
Then I was cute, not now.
They became friends, but he had a girlfriend. And eventually my mom moved away to California.
So I came from Chicago to California with the idea of finding Barbara because I knew she was here. And I was in love with her for about 11 years.
They cared about the same politics, and they laughed at the same things, despite being from different worlds, and despite my dad living in constant culture shock. He came from a small village in Ayabaca, Peru.
It was so different in the sense that I felt like the only common thing that existed between my village and Chicago was really the moon.
My cousin Rosa grew up in that world, too. She stopped by my house in Berkeley this morning on her way to see my grandpa. She spends almost every day with him because she's his caretaker. But she's not taking care of her grandpa. It's the one on my Jewish side. We pull up to my aunt's house, a big old brown shingle covered in vines. Rosa's baby, Ziva, is almost two. My grandpa, Quentin Young, moved into my aunt's house a couple of years ago because he was getting older and needing more care. Recently, he started to need almost constant attention, so the family decided to hire Rosa.
Shh, shh, he's awake, okay?
Hi, Grandpa.
Hi.
Hi.
Rosa.
How are you, Grandpa?
Some days, Grandpa's more with it. Other days, he talks about death a lot.
I should be moving on.
You really think so?
I was born in 1923. Well, I've been very fortunate, really.
He has. He was raised in Chicago by Jewish immigrants from Russia and Lithuania. He had a bar mitzvah. He spoke some Hebrew.
We went to high holidays. But we weren't religious. I know that sounds ridiculous.
He was a doctor who later became a leader in the movement for single-payer healthcare, or nationalized medicine. He was the head of two national organizations and a close friend of former Illinois Governor Pat Quinn. When Martin Luther King Jr. was in Chicago in the 60s, my grandpa was his doctor. He misses Chicago and he misses his wife. She was a lot younger than he was and died too soon.
Oh, me. She was wonderful. She was.
Here in Berkeley, he's surrounded by family. And during the weekdays, he has Rosa and Ziva.
Yeah, I call him Grandpa. I feel him as a family. I never saw him as somebody strange.
My cousin Rosa lived in Peru until she was 21. Before she moved in with my family into my room, I'd only met her and the rest of my Peruvian family once when I was 3.
We have this image of you guys of being kind of so far, up in the sky or something like that, or tio Feli. He got married with somebody, a white person, a gringuita, stuff like that. But we are not able to really connect to him. Until I start, living with him,
Yeah, for me, it started when you moved into the house. But it wasn't until I lived in South America for a little bit that I was able to really make the connection with the family and to being Peruvian. I studied in Bolivia for a semester back in college. I spent the summer with my family in Peru and began to understand that side of my family better. And when Rosa came here, she got to understand my family better too.
And what I really like, I don't know if that's something you should know, but it's how open you are and talking to each other about your feelings.
She says for the family in Peru, people keep things to themselves.
I learned how to open myself in here, kind of more be more expressive. I feel happier.
Now she spends a lot of her time with Grandpa, who's actually my grandpa. And as he ages, he's become subdued. Rosa didn't know Grandpa when he was this commanding presence in any room. My mom described what it was like having him for a father.
Well, my dad was very much of an activist in every way.
And he was progressive about race issues, too.
The racial consciousness and racial justice was something that I feel like I was weaned on. It was always around. It was always an issue.
Her world was integrated, but race was still a huge fault line. In the Bay Area, as an adult, she didn't recognize such deep divisions. By the time she got married to my dad, she didn't even think interracial marriage would be a big deal. Every once in a while, though, she was reminded.
I had sent Grandpa's parents a picture of Feli and myself that was a really lovely picture. We were all dressed up. And I sent it to them, and they always put up all kinds of pictures on the wall. And I remember when I went to visit them, they didn't have the picture up. And I realized it was because they were ashamed of this brown-skinned man.
Well, were you worried that they were going to be ashamed of me?
I don't think I ever thought about anybody in my family being ashamed of you.
And she was right, mostly. But she also didn't think to prepare me for the experience of being mixed, how I'd have to navigate that. The little ways, for example, my schoolmates expected me to choose sides. Friends of color might comment on how many white friends I had. White friends would talk about my, quote, Latina curves. The only time I'm not aware of my identity or managing how people are reading me is when I'm with my closest friends or family, or when I'm by myself. My mom didn't realize that until I was much older.
You didn't come home. I don't recall either one of you coming home to me and saying, Mom, the kids are asking me and I don't know what to say, or
I'm telling him this, is this right? I don't remember ever hearing about that as a conflict.
But I think that I didn't know how to bring it up with you. We just didn't know how to bring it up with you without making you feel bad. Like, without making you feel like we're blaming you because you're white. But we did always feel like we had to choose, or that there was, like, times that you didn't really get it, or, like...
Is there something that I should have done around that issue?
I guess what I wish we could have gotten when we were younger was kind of, like, a more realistic view.
You mean that you would be discriminated against because you were... because of the Latina side? Or
just that people wouldn't get it.
Well, I think, you know, I hear what you're saying, that you wish I could have dealt with it somehow more clearly and directly, and just even grappled with it at all, you know, brought it up and talked about it. I think I really was not thinking about it being an issue. I didn't really realize that till you, both of you, did get older and start talking with me about it.
It's okay that my mom couldn't prepare me for being mixed. I'm only now learning that my family won't make sense to a lot of people. Though my mom didn't realize it when she coined it, this word, Mashuganismo, has helped me make sense of my identity. Because it combines two cultures into one, I can be a combination of two cultures. I'm just Mashuganismo, a mix. It might not translate to the rest of the world, but that's okay. It doesn't have to.
That piece was produced by Maya Cueva and KALW's Liza Zeal. Feliz Pesach and Happy Passover, everyone. This episode originally aired in December of 2015 and was produced by Michael Simon Johnson, Daisy Rosario, Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Fernanda Chavarri, Antonia Cerejido, Julia Alsop, Sarah Barrett, and Julia Hsu. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, you can look for us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Shalom, todo mundo. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Shlemiel's the guy that spills his soup?
Yeah.
And Shlemazel what?
Shlemazel has to mop it up.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And Margot and John Ernst, supporting North Country Public Radio in Canton, New York, and NPR's environmental coverage, which helps to raise awareness on issues surrounding climate change. This is NPR.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, next time on Latino USA.
I didn't realize I was brown until I got here. You're a part of everyday life, hustle and bustle. You're just like everybody else. And then when you come to Iowa and you realize, like, oh, wow, things are different.
That's next time on Latino USA.